It's kind of a pretty massive problem that a lot of banks are trying to figure out. Do we just extend and pretend, right? Do we just extend the maturities of these loans and hope that they can build up, you know, net interest income or net operating income to service the debt? Well, meanwhile, we're having, like in a lot of markets, rent growth, negative rent growth, right? So rent declines. So that's putting downward pressure on net operating income. And we're having really high operating expenses increases, especially insurance is going up.
Welcome to the Ultra High Net Worth Podcast, which is a global community of the most successful and their insights. We want our families to flourish, collaborate, and create a better world for all. This podcast is a trusted resource to learn from each other, navigate the most important global issues, and find life-changing opportunities. I'm the host, Jonathan Tuttle, the founder at Midwest Park Capital, a boutique mobile home park real estate fund, RevenueSend, a leading digital consulting and fractional CMO agency, Business Cash Out, a boutique M&A firm focused on service-based businesses, and a part of the founding team at Wally Pop, a mood-enhancing kava beverage. This episode is sponsored by Prestige, the world's most exclusive social networking app. All links are in the show notes below. Enjoy the show. Please like, comment, and share this podcast with your friends. Thanks for listening. Welcome to the very first episode of the Ultra High Net Worth Podcast. And today I have a fantastic guest and fits perfectly with this whole symmetry of the show. It's Ben Fraser from Aspen Funds and also Invest Like a Billionaire Podcast. Welcome to the first episode.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. Jonathan, it's going to be fun.
Yeah, it's going to be exciting. And so it's kind of perfectly fitting because it's a very similar demographic to your podcast and what your fund is. Do you just want to give a little background about yourself?
Yeah, sure. So we have a podcast called Invest Like a Billionaire, and it's really trying to identify and learn from the ultra wealthy investors, a lot of ones that I'm sure you're going to have on this show. And how are they investing? How are they investing differently than, you know, so the average retail investor, what we call them, just individual investors that aren't quite at the family office level, you know, but we want to take, you know, the best tactics and strategies and tools that they're using and apply it in a smaller scale. And so that's our whole focus. That's what we spend a lot of time doing. And we also operate and run funds in different verticals. So I'm actually the chief investment officer of Aspen Funds and really boots on the ground. So the education is fun, but it's actually, you know, secondary job for me.
Nice, nice. Yeah, it's, I recommend listening to the podcast. It's pretty fascinating because you guys have a diverse, it's not just one, because a lot of the, you know, if you see a lot of these podcasts, it's just one same topic over and over. But there's, you know, obviously with investing, you want to be diversified and have see where emerging trends are, opportunities, and you guys do a good job of covering different things. What are some of your kind of favorite opportunities? Let's say, because it sounds weird, we're almost going to 2024 now. What do you see as some of the best opportunities going forward in early next year?
Yeah, you know, you kind of mentioned it, but our approach is a little bit different than some, right? So a lot of operators or sponsors that are putting together these private equity deals or real estate deals or oil and gas deals, they're focused on that singular asset class, that singular business. And we really chose several years ago to have a different approach and really be what we call asset class agnostic, right? So we're not locked into one asset class because inevitably, asset classes go in cycles, right? There's really good times to be in certain asset classes, and then there's not so good times to be in asset classes. And we're seeing this right now, you know, even in the commercial real estate space and other asset classes that, you know, there's kind of these booms and busts, right? And as investors, you don't want to have all your eggs in one basket, and you want to have that diversification, but you also want to invest in the tides, right? You want to invest in where do you have the tailwinds behind your back? They're going to help you directionally, you know, outperform the market because you're in the areas that are kind of poised to do better than others. And so we kind of take more of a family office approach in that part of the motivation for us to utilize this model was to deploy our own capital. And so we have four partners, and this is really our own portfolio allocation strategy is we invest alongside all of our investors in every deal we do. And really to get that the broader exposure, but then also not being locked into one asset class. So that's the long way to answer, you know, your simple question, which is where do we see opportunities? But it's important because investors, we intuitively understand that timing is important, But a lot of people believe that you can't time the markets, right? And there is a certain element to, like, you can't day trading is a hard thing to do, right? You can't, what's the market going to do today? I don't know. But directionally, where's the economy going and where are the fundamental supply and demand, you know, dissonances where there's actually opportunity in the market that we can capture as investors and play into a longer term theme? Those can be identified and those can be taken advantage of as investors. So that's what we're looking for. We're seeing those opportunities selectively still in multifamily. So it's harder and harder to find deals, but I think we're kind of getting close to the point where the deals are going to start making sense again, right? Yeah. And what's really interesting is I saw a quote today actually on usually at like the best times to be buying real estate and in a certain asset class is usually when there's not a lot of excitement about it and when the credit has really tightened up and it's hard to get financing for deals. That's usually actually the best time to be buying, right? Because there's kind of a dislocation in the market. It's a little harder to get deals done. The worst time to be buying is when it's really easy to get really high leverage. Everyone's talking about that asset class and everyone's in it, right? That, so it's this kind of contrarian investment, you know, approach. And so we are seeing some opportunities because on a long-term scale, not even that long-term, I think 2 to 4 years, we're going to be in a major housing shortage that we're already kind of in and have been in for a while, but it's going to be exacerbated because a lot of the new construction, new development has been kind of falling off a cliff this year because of higher interest rates. And so we're kind of just continuing to build this big lack of supply. We're very, very bullish on industrial right now. It's probably our number one real estate vertical. If you look at all commercial real estate asset classes since the beginning of the year, values wise, it's probably been the least impacted by the interest rates, industrial it is. And we kind of believe we're at the beginning of kind of what we call phase 2.0 industrial boom, where the last one was created by e-commerce, right? The last industrial boom over the past decade has been really driven by growth in e-commerce. And that's not necessarily stopping, but it's the growth is slowing in that. And the next kind of wave that we believe is really going to be driven by manufacturing, reshoring manufacturing back to the US and bringing back more inventory warehousing of kind of critical components and things in the supply chain. And then outside of real estate, we're very, very bullish on fossil fuels, right? And that one, you know, might be confusing to people because, you know, hey, we don't need fossil fuels anymore. We're going all electric and alternative energy sources. But there's kind of a big gap between now and then, and probably many decades between now and then. And in the short term, we're creating a potential massive energy crisis because we're not investing in new supply of fossil fuels. And, you know, we need this. It's the kind of core commodity of so many parts of our industry, manufacturing, transportation, that it's, you know, over the next couple of years, we think, you know, prices have a lot of room to run to the upside.
Yeah, I agree with that. A lot of that sentiments. I have three e-com stores myself. So two of my partners are in the U.S. and industrial places. So that's, you know, e-com has been a huge boom for industrial. And then with the, you said fossil fuels, like the U.S. wants to get everything to, you know, to everyone driving Teslas, but the infrastructure is not set up for like probably, I heard like maybe like 2045, 2050, something like that. Like it's a long ways out. Like, it's just a huge gap there. What is what's your thoughts on like other alternative assets, real estate? It's like, because I'm in mobile home parks and I saw you have a couple mobile home park guys in the past few episodes. What's kind of your thoughts on that niche? Because it's kind of very comparable. If you look at Green Street data, you mentioned industrial. In the last few years, it's been industrial, mobile home parks, and self-storage is like three of the top performing asset classes. And just on the Green Street data, institutional data, what's kind of your thoughts on that? Have you guys ever explored that at all? Or is that just because it's obviously an alternative?
Yeah, absolutely. We've not directly sponsored any mobile home park investments. I know a lot of operators that are in that space. I'm also very bullish on it, right? I think it plays into a lot of themes, one being lack of affordable housing. I think that's going to continue to be a massive issue that we need to solve as a country. And we're not doing a great job of that. You know, all the new construction that's coming online is generally at the higher end of the market because they have to make a profit and the fixed overhead costs of traditional construction are prohibitive to, you know, build those entry-level homes. And from a capital market standpoint, my understanding of the mobile home space is that it's pretty fragmented, whereas multifamily is predominantly institutionally owned. Mobile home parks are predominantly mom and pop owned, right? So there's a lot of fractionalization and, you know, create some opportunity if you can aggregate that. The challenge is, you know, it's difficult to find deals, and some of the deals that do come to market trade for very, very aggressive pricing. So I'm not in the market to know what's going on, and, you know, on the pricing side of it, but from an asset class standpoint, I think there's a lot of opportunity there for sure.
And where do you think the rates are going? Because obviously, the rates have been such the game changer for this year, because the Fed, it's been just a night and day difference between, you know, last year and this year, and, you know, the shock it put in the market. Where do you see the rates kind of settling after all the dust settles?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, we're here in the first episode, so we don't want to date ourselves when people go back and listen to this later. So we're at the, you know, in September 2023, so we can date it.
Yeah, keep it timestamp.
Yeah, we got a timestamp, because things will probably change over the next year.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, we've seen the fastest rise of interest rates in history.
Yeah.
And I don't think we've yet to see the full consequences of that in the market, right? It's happened so fast, it's difficult for the market to digest what that means and what the real impacts are, right? We potentially saw a little bit of breakage happening in the banking industry. I think some of that's been, settled, but I think there's a lot of challenges facing, you know, several areas of the economy. And, you know, right now we're at interest rates, you know, at prime's over 8%, you know, and the yield curve is massively inverted, which is not a good thing. Yeah. And so where do rates go from now? I mean, if you believe the futures curve, you know, maybe a year from now, we're 100 basis points lower than we are right now. I think SOFR is about 5%, you know, Fed funds rate's about 5.25%. And so maybe we drop down to low fours. But part of the challenge and part of the, you know, issue that I see going forward in the short term is the main reason that the Fed is increasing interest rates is inflation, right? Yeah. And we've had higher inflation than they're comfortable with. And they've stuck very firmly to want to hit their guidance target of 2%. Well, that's a noble goal, but I think in the short term, next couple of years, they're going to have a very difficult time getting back to that number for a few reasons. One, we have a massive labor shortage. And this is kind of, you know, post-COVID, a lot of people left the workforce. So a lot of kind of retiring baby boomers, you know, left and retired early. And then a lot of kind of dual income families, because of all the extra, you know, incentives going on, and the job market was super hot, kind of went to single income families. And so one's staying home now. And so we're sitting at unemployment under 4%. And that puts a massive amount of pressure on the kind of wages. And wages are, you know, inflating very, very high right now, very, very quickly. And so it puts a lot of pressure on, you know, the other parts of the economy, and inflation is consumer spending, is one of the core drivers of GDP growth. Yep. And so we have a lot of pressure on the labor market. I don't think it's going to get loose anytime soon. We're seeing some layoffs, especially in tech, but as a percentage of the whole economy, and, you know, it's still very, very low. I mean, I think there's now right now more job openings than people looking for jobs, and we still have that issue right a year into this really unique economy of these higher interest rates. So that's going to keep putting pressure on inflation. Meanwhile, you know, we'll have time probably to dig into all the things going on in energy right now. But if, you know, there's a few things that could just kind of get tipped off and we go back to really high, you know, energy prices, you know, gas prices, that puts a lot of pressure on CPI. And so I think we're still kind of, we got inflation on this downward trend, but to kind of get it down where they really wanted to stay there, it's going to take a lot longer than I think anyone really wants to admit it's going to take. So what does that mean for interest rates? I think it's going to force them to have to keep interest rates higher for longer. So whenever we're doing deals or we're underwriting deals, we're making that assumption, right? That rates will actually you know, going to be higher than they are right now, you know, and it's going to be longer than we wanted. So that makes it difficult to make deals work because, you know, I think those are, you know, pretty conservative assumptions, but I also think that's the world that we may be going into, right? This kind of muddle through, you know, economy. We have some very strong parts of the economy, have some kind of weaker parts of the economy. It's this kind of oscillation, you know, in the market trying to find itself. So very, again, a very long answer to your simple question, but I think we're going to start to see some breakage here pretty soon. The biggest area I see, just because of my focus on commercial real estate, is a lot of these, this bridge debt that is coming due over the next 12 months, right? So you're probably very aware of this, where over the past several years, most of the multifamily especially was purchased with bridge debt. And so this was very high leverage financing, generally between 80 and 90% financing. These were non-recourse loans. They're very attractive to operators, but they generally were floating rate interest rates, right? Yep. Which at that point, no one cared about because we were
3%
interest rates higher than, you know, than 4% forever. And all of a sudden, all of these deals are now having to service interest rates of 9-10%. And there is a ratings agency, Fitch, that came out recently and forecasted, you know, of all the loans that are maturing in 2023, only, you know, 25% of those loans would not meet debt service coverage requirements to refinance. I mean, there's not enough income being generated at the property level to even get refinanced out of their first mortgage. So what does that mean? One, the equity is already wiped in those deals and people don't know it yet, you know, and then two, there's a big kind of looming problem that is going to have to be addressed at some point, right? Because if it kind of happens in a one-off way, banks will kind of deal with it as it comes and it's not going to, you know, kill the market, but it's kind of a pretty massive problem that a lot of banks are trying to figure out. Do we just extend and pretend, right? Do we just extend the maturities of these loans and hope that they can build up, you know, net interest income or net operating income to service the debt? Well, meanwhile, we're having, like in a lot of markets, rent growth, negative rent growth, right? So rent declines. So that's putting downward pressure on net operating income. And we're having really high operating expenses increases, especially insurance is going up. So you're having these like three factors that are compressing margins and putting a lot of pressure on some of these deals in the short term, which is why I think there's going to be a lot of opportunity, you know, hitting the market here pretty soon. And you referenced before we hit record, we just did an episode talking about there's, I think just the articles that we were reading, over $200 billion. This is just a few weeks ago that this article came out that has been, that is being raised right now by very large private equity funds to scoop up distressed commercial real estate, right? And they're just waiting to pounce on these deals. So this is a weird and crazy thing is going on in the market right now.
Yeah, it's like you said, they're all compounding in with the, and the thing finding deals is the sellers had these offers last year because the rates were so low. And then they have the expectation, the mindset, especially at least the mom and pop, at least non-sophisticated, which I deal more with. Oh, my price is this because that's what they were telling me last year. Well, their rates were also half off, you know, so that equity and that expectation, they're like, you know, they assume that they could get that price forever because, you know, but those offers are getting rescinded. And same thing you're saying, like a lot of people are buying, like just too many people are buying deals in the fours and trying to do like this 2 year, like I said, and now they're everything's compounding. Like, well, we thought we could exit out. So it's going to be opportunity, but also I think there's going to be some, like, I guess you call it chaos in the market with some of these deals that the banks can't figure out. Your episode was talking about the office space. Like, I'm working, a big trend now is a digital nomads. I come down to Mexico and work for a month, and it's, you know, that's kind of like, this is my office right now.
Right.
So, you know, it's, you know, trends of, if you can work online, you could get all your work done. That's becoming like more attractive to people, you know, nowadays. What was one of your favorite episodes, guests? Like, I know it's like, you had like 105, 120 episodes. What was your favorite without like, because I know you may offend somebody, but like, what was your favorite, most intriguing guest that you had or episode?
Oh man, that's hard to put me on the spot here. You know, some of my favorite, I love like the macro conversations. And so we've had John Chang on. earlier this year. We're trying to get him back on again. He's kind of senior vice president over economic research at Marcus & Millichap. And I just love his perspective. I think talking kind of big picture. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of really fun interviews with like other passive investors. So I really enjoy those. One of them we had recently, I really enjoy, is Justin Donald. He's the lifestyle investor, great podcast he runs. That's a really fun episode. Honestly, we do so many, I kind of forget who's kind of been recently, but those are some ones that come to mind.
Nice. Yeah. Just curious. Cause, kind of plug for your show, but it's cool. Like to have that, one thing about being in a podcast, you get to see other people's perspectives and get the access to a lot of people. So I've been on 60 episodes myself. And then I was like, you know what? I'm going to start my own.
Yeah, exactly.
I was like, at least I can control it, you know, the flow of like the episodes and the communication. What's kind of your goals for Aspen Fund? What's kind of like you guys going to build up style to big PE firm, or was it kind of keep it like boutique between your partners, or what's kind of like your 5-year, 10-year plan with your fund?
Yeah. I mean, we've been going over 10 years at this point, and you know, we've had great growth. And we have pretty big goals that we've set, but for us, it's not about necessarily just growing fast and growing, you know, for no purpose. We do have a real mission and vision to help, you know, accredited investors and folks just like the ones you're working with to be able to have access to opportunities that they otherwise wouldn't. And, you know, with the changes in the Jobs Act in 2012, it's really changed the game for investors that they have now access to the types of deals, opportunities, asset classes that they never had before. And so we actually think we're in the very early stages of a pretty big shift of capital markets, you know, to the private market. We've already seen that happen over the past decade, but I think there's still a lot more of that market shift, right? And our goal is continue to do good deals and deals we believe in. You know, part of this strategy, the way we've set it up, is our own legacy strategy with our own capital, right? So we want to be doing deals for a long time and have people invest alongside of us. But the education piece of it is not anything I ever imagined we'd do, right? We didn't start the podcast. Well, we started 2 years ago, and really just as a way for us to share market insights and talk about things we're seeing. And so it's been really fun because it's not anything I imagined, you know, I'd be doing this kind of education or conversations around, but definitely have built a passion for it. So it's been really fun.
Nice. Yeah. It's a good podcast. When you talk about the 506, it was in 2012. I met Robert Edward Grant. I think he said he had the very first like PPM for raising capital. Like he knew, like,
oh, wow.
He knew like Obama was going to pass it. And he like, there's something like they knew like what was going to happen. Like they were literally the first one to do a private placement in a 506. He raised like $250 million. It was like crazy.
Wow.
And he said he did it in like a week, he said. But he's he was a former of Pfizer, former CEO, like all these billion-dollar-plus companies. So he knew all the doctors and his distributors and everything. So that was his like, you know, audience. And he was a CEO of a couple of like billion-dollar companies. So that helped a lot. But
yeah, that definitely helps.
Yeah, but it's pretty cool that the 506, and then now you have the crowdfunding. I remember the first came out, I was like, this is pretty cool. Like, and now they're actually opening up a lot more accredited investor status. Is a lot more if you have some kind of financial background. I don't know the exact stipulations, but it's like I think if you have
Series 7 or 63, I believe.
That's 63. Yeah. Okay, yeah. So they're opening up to more people. And when they originally came out with it, I think obviously with inflation, going back to inflation, $200,000 was a lot of money. I think it was like 1979 or something like that was when they first came out with the, it was like late 70s or early 80s. And so 200,000 back then, the calculator, probably $500,000, you know?
Yeah.
So big difference.
Yeah, they definitely seem to be trending that direction. You know, it's kind of interesting because there's a bill right now to pass, I forget if it's in the center of the house, but to where you can actually take a test and not even like one of the traditional financial tests, but just, you know, do you understand the basics of investing and, you know, the actual test that anybody could take and become accredited, whether they make a lot of money or don't. And that's on the table, which is pretty interesting because that would expand it even further.
Right.
But on the flip side of it, we just saw something that did get passed that puts a pretty big onus of new reporting requirements, of new transparency guidelines on private fund advisors, which is mostly kind of hedge funds, and puts a lot more kind of operational load, you know, reporting compliance on them. So that's, you know, I kind of see both happening, right? Because, you know, we may, if we kind of go through a pretty, you know, decent dip here on some of these deals, that equity gets wiped, investors get mad, there's some lawsuits, there's, you know, already some things that are happening in the market that are interesting, right? Some of the bad actors are kind of being revealed. I think it's going to create a little bit of heartburn, right, with some investors, and like, hey, I was promised all of this and it didn't turn out that way. So that may create a little bit more emphasis from the, you know, politicians to put more regulation, reporting, compliance in the space. And you know, I'm generally not a huge proponent of that, but you know, to some degree, I think that could be helpful, just to increase, you know, trust for the individual investors, increase transparency, which is kind of a knock for alternatives. But it does seem that the trend generally is kind of going that direction to create more access, open it up to more people. And, you know, if you look at one of my favorite sources on finding data on the ultra wealthy is Tiger 21, right? These are ultra high net worth folks that are in this group, and they generally post on a quarterly basis, you know, what's the overall allocation pie, right, of all the members across different asset classes. And it changes, you know, from quarter to quarter a little bit, but predominantly it's 50% alternatives, 25% public markets, and 25% lots of other stuff. And that seems a pretty common theme, even as you go into, you know, bigger institutional money like family offices, endowments, pensions, et cetera, that there's usually a pretty big allocation to these private alternatives. And so that's what the ultra wealthy are doing. And now, you know, the average accredited investor is having more access to those. So I do think there's going to be a continued kind of trend toward that.
Yeah, I agree with that too, that sentiment. It's just the fact that accredited have access to these deals, which we've never accessed it before, just It's a good thing they allowed that. You know, it was a game changer for the average person to kind of bump up to the qualified purchaser, you know, the next level. And what are some of the funds or some of the asset classes you're gonna be focused on with the Aspen Fund this year? Is it gonna be mostly like percentage wise? Is it gonna be like half commercial or multifamily? What's kind of your allocation you're thinking for the next year?
Yeah. So we have kind of three primary funds that we run. One is our debt fund. So it's buying mortgage notes. We've been doing that for a long time. And then we have our oil and gas fund. And so we usually raise for one fund a year. That's going to be probably our biggest allocation this year. So we're kind of the tail end of that raise. And then we have our real estate fund, and we kind of consolidate all of our deals into one fund. So kind of a diversified portfolio. And again, asset classes vary, but we're doing some multifamily, we're doing some industrial, or we're doing a little bit of storage and retail are kind of our four verticals there. So, you know, it'll probably be an even mix between those three, with the bigger one being probably oil and gas, just given the level of opportunity in that space right now.
Yeah, the self-storage, I like that niche too. You're seeing a lot of conversions where it's retail. If you're doing both, they'll do like a retail, like a major, let's say like a regional supermarket left. They bring in and make an AC focused, at least in the Midwest, where I see a lot, where they bring in and make it self-storage. Have you guys done some of those conversions like that, or are you guys just buying mom pops?
We have, yeah. I mean, I think that's the real play, because if you go to kind of a traditional stabilized self-storage deal, it's being operated by a major.
No value add.
You're going to be paying such a hefty, you know, penny for those. But the conversions are really interesting. And so we actually are just finished construction of one of our conversions, or actually taking it to market right now just to kind of see values and see if it makes sense to sell. But it's looking like it's going to be a home run, just because the basis for converting kind of existing is exactly that, a vacant retail strip center in a really good area of town, right by two main highways, great visibility, but just sat empty. And converted to climate controlled storage, the only climate controlled storage in the area. And, you know, we're starting to lease it up, which is great, but the lease up takes a long time in storage, because it's, you know, it's onesie twosies. We have, I think, 900 plus units in this property. So it's pretty large. But the value that we created by kind of converting this property from retail to storage has created a whole lot more value to investors just on the potential. So it's a really cool strategy. They're sometimes hard to find, but when you find a good one in a really good area. And the thing about storage is so different than every other asset classes is, you know, real estate is local, right? Real estate happens in the local market, but self-storage is a whole other level. It's not just local, it's hyper-local, right? Yeah. And you have to, all your data centers around that kind of 5 to 7 mile radius. And that's what you're competing against, because the users of self-storage generally don't want to drive more than 10 minutes to the storage facility, right? That's just kind of the nature of the product. And so your competition is in that really hyper-local market. And that's what you're evaluating when you're looking at storage versus multifamily. It can be a little bit broader. You know, you have your class A, B, C, you know, different vintages, different types of tenants. But storage, it's a whole other level. So it's really matters at that level.
Yeah, I have a friend who owns a decent amount. He says that, I think it's a funny quote. He's like, your biggest competitor is a trash can.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, do so I funny. Throw it away or do I keep it?
Yeah, do I keep it in there for 20? So we average, 22 months for a retail person and 24 months approximately for, that's for like the length of-
On average length of lease? That's a good question. Nationally, I don't know what the number is. It sounds about right. And, you know, obviously, we're just leasing up ours. So ours has only been leasing for a couple months. Right. We don't have that data anecdotally on that property, but I think that sounds about right. It's pretty sticky. Right. Mm-hmm. Once you get somebody in and you kind of price it at a point where it's $100 a month.
Yeah.
You know, it's not enough to where, you know, that's breaking the bank. And if you increase that $100 by 10% year over year, it's only $10 more. Yes.
Yeah.
You know, from your top line, that's 10% on the whole thing, which is huge. But from the consumer standpoint, it's not that meaningful, right? So the stickiness factor is very high in storage. Although it's really interesting, at a national level, we're actually seeing vacancy trending higher than we've seen in the past. So it's kind of been, you know, vacancy has been low, really high occupancy. All of a sudden, we're starting to see that tail off a little bit. So it's kind of I'm talking with some bigger self-storage operators in the space, and they're kind of seeing the same thing and saying, we're not quite sure what's happening in the market. What we think is happening is, you know, a lot of times storage activity is driven by you know, transition points in the economy. So whether we're really good and people are, you know, moving a lot, so they're needing some storage space, or things are not going so well, so there's people that are downsizing and they're kind of putting things in storage because they need a smaller house. We're kind of in this like precipice of people don't know what to expect or what's going to happen. And there's, I think, been like a 70 or 80% decrease in, you know, new homes being purchased and transacted on this year. So it's just been a slow market, which I think has resulted in slower, you know, leasing activity. This is in self-storage specifically, but it's, I think from a asset class standpoint, it's a great asset class with some pretty strong, you know, reasons to like it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I've always been a fan of it. It's anything with the mom and pop, because, you know, alternatives, that's where the arbitrage is, because a lot of times they don't know how to operate efficiently. They don't use technology to their advantage, and just maximization and profit loss. So like, if you look at the books, a lot of times they'll have like a kid's salaries on there. Like, oh, what's this? Oh, it's my daughter or son's salary. And so, okay, that's a lot. It's redlined out when we take it over. So
It's so funny. We were doing the competitor research for this one property. I mean, you would see these properties and laugh. I mean, they're so junky. They look like they look pretty close to the trash heap anyway. But then you go and you like talk about, you're trying to get a sense of, are these like well occupied? Do you have a lot of room, or are you kind of pretty well leased up? And one of the managers on site pulls out this little yellow notepad, and it just had handwritten names of, yeah, we're fully leased up, and we got here like 15 people on a wait list. And the wait list was on this yellow pad of people that had just come in. It's like that's their tracking system, right? And how they're tracking their leads. And what's so interesting about, you say, the mom and pop is the focus for mom and pops generally is occupancy, right? They think if it's 100% occupied, then they're winning. But generally, if you're 100% occupied, that means
you have raised pricing.
Is too low, right? Because it means you're not competitive enough, and you want to almost kind of thread that needle of, I want a little bit of vacancy because I want to be pushing the limits on pricing as much as I can to optimize where the market's at, and without going too far, right? So that's the interesting thing about self-storage, is because the contracts usually are month to month, you can be, you know, changing pricing pretty dynamically and get a sense of where the market's at, without, you know, breaking the model. So that's another cool aspect of it as well.
Yeah. No, it's very similar in mobile home parks. here's the books, and like Rent Manager. Well, Rent Manager is like a tool people don't know, for like online showing the rents being collected. But a lot of times, it's a piece of paper and here's the books. It's literally like, you know, old school binders and stuff like that. It's,
right.
You know, just even the due diligence takes an extra week, just because you're like, oh my gosh, I got to go through all this. Good thing I don't do like all the underwriting. I have somebody do that, because that's got to be a pain to look at all the pieces of paper on the handwriting and scribbles. So what's kind of personal goals for you in the next 5 years?
Yeah, personal goals. So I'm the chief investment officer, and just continuing to do more better deals. I mean, that's really what we're doing. We're on a fun growth path, so get to hire a lot of cool people, and really we're trying to do is build a brand that has a great reputation for finding best in class deals and helping lead the charge in the alternative investment space. So we're very big believers in you know, what these kind of deals can provide from a risk adjusted return standpoint and diversification standpoint. And just want to get more people in the boat. So yeah, I got four kids on the really personal side, and having some fun times there, and trying to be building a business and being a present dad at the same time. So those are always you know, sometimes competing priorities, but trying to have a good integration of work life.
Yeah, I love it. Yeah, that's very cool. And then, as we wrap this up, where can people find you, for the podcast, the fund, or anything other projects you're working on?
Yeah, I appreciate that. So our podcast is Invest Like a Billionaire. You can find any platform. You can go to thebillionairepodcast.com, check it out. And then our private equity firm is Aspen Funds. So aspenfunds.us. You can check us out there and see what we've got going on.
Well, appreciate it. It was a great conversation. I like how you really broke everything down to like a, you know, macro level with some, a lot of data insights. And I'll put all your links below. And thank you so much, Ben, for being on the podcast.
Thanks, Jonathan. It was really fun.
Thank you. Hey, it's Jonathan. Make sure to download and listen weekly as I bring the top guests in the ultra high net worth niche, sharing their best insights and providing exclusive resources. Finally, I get a lot of people asking me to help them one-on-one. Yes, I can, but it's very limited. Go to a Revenue Ascend for business and CMO consulting. For real estate investing, go to MidwestParkCapital.com. And those looking to invest in service-based business roll-ups, go to BusinessCashOut.com. All links are included below. Please like, comment, and share this podcast with your friends. Thanks for listening.